holder, reloader. Come at me, I'ma rip your soldiers in half. Silverback ape, nickel plated mag. Young, rich, and flashy. Young bitch, I'm nasty on black clothes. The ice lay on me so classy. And every time I close my lids, I can still see the barrel, I can still see the bridge, can still see the dreams that my niggas ain't never lived to see. Tell them angels open the door for me. From nine Berettas and moving raw, the chilling and wine cellar sticks and humidors. That's what I call mature, that's what I call a G, that's what I call a pimp, that's what I call a gangster to the fullest shit. I'm trying to make more cream by every September 14th. That's my dream, so I can be more clean as I grow yearly.
And I guess all the things you're sure to find for. Gee, I love to see you looking swell.
Well, my tailor's waiting right outside the door. Baby, you can give me looking swell. I'm glad.
Diamond bracelets, Woolworths, dozens. yourself.
I never had a diamond bracelet in my life. What do I want it for?
Till that lucky day, you know darn well.
What happens? What goes on in here?
Oh, baby, that I can't give you anything but love.
Come here, let me tell you something. I can't dish out anything but love. Baby, that's the only thing I've got plenty of. Baby, you talk about dreaming a while, scheming a while. You're sure to find happiness. And I guess all those fine Arabian things your little heart pines for, yeah. Skip 'em. I'd love to see you looking swell. Diamond bracelet? Woolworth ain't got no business selling them. You can go to, well. Until that lucky day, you know darn well. Well, baby, I ain't dishing out nothing, ain't getting off of nothing but love. How's that, babe? There's your diamond.
Hello, and welcome to the Pedal Revolutionary Show, broadcasting from the University of British Columbia, 101.9 FM, CITR. I hope everybody's enjoying the fine weather today, out on their bicycle, of course. We are Ifni less today. She wanted me to tell you all that she was trapped in a well, but the real truth is that she's hard at work right now writing a grant for Free Geek, and hopefully she'll get that done today, and so we can get lots of money in a couple of months, but we'll see what happens. So I don't know how many of you read the Metro News, but I picked a copy out of the garbage can, and something caught my eye. There's on page 12, an article under Going Green called Cycling Routes Not Equal. Some bicycle paths expose riders to more pollution than others. And this article goes on to tell us that experts believe that smaller, ultra-fine particles pose more serious health threats than the large ones. These ultra-fine particles are more likely found on high-traffic-type places with lots of cars. And they list the three routes that have the most pollution, and that is the Burrard Bridge, the West Georgia Street bike path, and Burrard Street. But interestingly enough, there is a study that shows that concentrations of these ultrafine particles are encountered by cyclists are often much lower than those measured inside a car. So not only are you doing better for the environment, but apparently you're doing better for yourself when you're taking a bicycle and not a car. And speaking of cars, there are many places in Vancouver where we see traffic calming measures, whether it be roundabout circles or those yellow concrete pylons that separate streets so that cars can't drive through, but bicycles can. And there's one at Franklin and Semlin, where I live near, that has about 10 of those yellow concrete pylons. But on one side, they seem to have missed placing one, and so there's about a 3-meter gap there. And every morning on my walk to work, a number of drivers use this gap in the pylons to drive through to continue their westbound travel on Franklin to get to Victoria instead of having to go around. A couple days ago, I was walking on the north sidewalk and, much to my surprise, found a SUV bearing down on me, because if you use this little loophole trick that the drivers have found out, you have to drive down the north sidewalk to get back onto Franklin. So I tried my own personal measures to stop this, dirty faces, yelling at cars. That didn't work. So I placed a large piece of wood in the 3-meter gap, which, of course, the drivers had moved. So lately, I've been making it a personal goal to interact with the city of Vancouver more. Yes, City Hall on Cambie Street, and to see how my taxpaying money can be put to work. And today, much to my surprise, I find that sometimes communicating with City Hall can be a pleasurable and quick experience. I sent an email yesterday at around 3:30 to a gentleman in the traffic calming department named Scott, explaining my concerns about this traffic calming area. I didn't think my email would make it far or do much, but I figured it was at least worth a try. And so at 9 o'clock this morning, I got an email saying, thank you very much for your email, and we're going to look into it. So on my way to work today, around 10:30, I saw one of those little smart cars, little tiny ones that the city uses, parked at Franklin and Semlin, and I walked up to the gentleman, and I said, are you here about the traffic calming situation? He says, yes, I am. I said, oh, I wrote that email. And he's, oh, nice to meet you. And we talked about it for a little bit, and he said, you know, while I was sitting here taking notes, somebody actually drove through, and so I got to witness, you know, what your problem is, sir. I said, oh, that's great. And I walked him over, and I showed him my log of wood that the drivers keep removing, and he said, no problem. We're going to send the city down and put another yellow pylon to make the 3-meter gap back to much a smaller size so cars can't make it through. So I'm happy to say that it's worth trying talking to the city. They actually do things sometimes, and in a pretty timely fashion too. So if you find some things in your neighborhood aren't working out, and especially when it comes to cars messing with you, do drop an email to the city, and I'm sure you'd be pleasantly surprised. So today, we are going to be listening to a broadcast of a radio show from the BBC called The Fall and Rise of the Bicycle, and we are going to listen to an episode that was broadcast the 24th of July, 2006, called Europe, the Once and Future King of the Road. And basically, this broadcast, well, I'll read you the description on the website, and that'd probably do better justice than me. Mark Steven discovers the importance of the bicycle as a global barometer of social, economic, and environmental change. Over 200 years after its invention, it could be that the humble bike will once again be king of the road in the developed world. Alongside an increasing number of commuters, Mark Steven braves the city the cycle lanes of London, England. He then travels to Denmark to discover whether a cycling revolution in the UK could ever match the number of cyclists who take the streets of bicycle-friendly European cities like Copenhagen. This show runs about a half hour long, and I hope you enjoy it. Okay, we seem to be having some technical difficulties with the BBC. I'm going to throw some music on and see if I can't sort that out. Thank you.
Tiempo News.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that, and I think I've figured out the BBC error. But before we go to the show, I would like to make an opportunity to give some tickets away to the, and I'm going to pronounce this wrong, I know, the Cyper Famous B-Boy Championships, and I think this is some sort of breakdancing competition. The show before us, Crimes and Treasons, has asked me to give away some more tickets. So during this BBC episode about bicycles, please do give me a call and I can put your name down for a ticket. It's this Saturday, July 19th at the Sub Ballroom at UBC. So once again, that's the Cyper Famous B-Boy Championships, a breakdancing competition, Saturday, July 19th, Sub Ballroom UBC. You can tell I don't go to UBC. Anyways, do give us a call, 604-UBC-CITR. And here is the BBC.
More news.
In half an hour, Andrew Marr and his guests will be here to start the week. First here on BBC Radio 4, the fall and rise of the bicycle. Cycling through the streets of London and Copenhagen, Mark Stephen focuses on the resurgence of the humble bicycle, and whether its position within the transport pecking order is a barometer for economic and environmental change.
Okay, yeah.
The great thing that the bicycle can do for you is to wean you off the fossil fuel addiction. It's one of the few things which is going to give us hope for the future. That could put us on the road to sustainability faster and quicker than almost any other single change in our personal habits.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I'm standing here in Copenhagen, and this is basically cycling heaven. This is as good as it gets. There are as many people cycling on my right-hand side as there are cars on the road. In fact, there's considerably more than there are cars on the road. And you look at the cyclists, and they're young, they're old, they're male, they're female, some of them are heavily pregnant. There was a woman cycled past in this special family type of bike with three kids in the front just seconds ago. We're accustomed to thinking of this as being a European, a mainland European phenomenon. It belongs to cities like this one, Copenhagen, or Amsterdam, or Berlin. But are we beginning to see the same kind of thing happening in the UK?
My name's Andrew Sims, and I'm the policy director at the New Economics Foundation and do our work on climate change. If you take a measure of people's general life satisfaction and say, for example, put it in the context of another measure like the size of the ecological footprint we have, in other words, how much of the planet's resources we're eating up to try and give ourselves a good life, and then put those two things together, and maybe looking at bicycle use is one of the things that you can include, then you're starting to get towards a very deep and meaningful indicator that should be pointing the way forward for, you know, living well within the environmental limits of the planet. Now, the bicycle is particularly interesting, of course, because compared to that other form of personal transport, the car, its ecological footprint is tiny. Once you've made the thing, you're powering it yourself. So the bicycle could be a very useful indicator of sustainable development.
Standing here in Hyde Park Corner, between Hyde Park and basically Green Park behind us, and there's just swarms of cyclists heading past. To give you the location, I'm actually standing almost on an island. This is the biggest roundabout, one of the busiest roundabouts in London. And every morning, people get the sheer unadulterated pleasure of cycling through one of the greenest parts of London. They come to this really busy traffic junction, the lights change, and this swarm of cyclists shoot across the road, straight underneath the arch there, and into the next park. It's absolutely wonderful seeing so many people on bikes right in the heart of our biggest city.
My name's Tom Bogdanovich. I'm a campaigns and development manager with the London Cycling Campaign. Cycling has grown remarkably in London since the year 2000. We've seen a more than 70% increase in cycling up till now on major roads. That's probably one of the highest growths in cycling anywhere in the world in such a short space of time.
Anybody who hasn't cycled in London, you would probably regard it with absolute horror. I mean, the concept of getting out in that traffic, which is just a maelstrom. Tell me about the joys of cycling in London. I mean, where's a real pleasurable route for you?
Well, what people forget is that 90% of the roads in London are side streets. Most of those side streets have no traffic at all, or very little. And that's where cyclists go, and they love it. I mean, going through somewhere like Hyde Park of a morning or of an evening is just pure joy. I mean, it's inspirational. It makes you want to cycle. I think it's great that we have these parks in London where people can just enjoy their cycling. Richmond Park, I mean, it's just great. You know, I cycle through as much park as I can on the way into work, and then I walk across the Millennium Bridge, and I'm inspired. My journey into town is my favourite bit of the day. If it wasn't for that, I'd feel sort of, you know, constrained and stressed by the time I got to work. I arrive rejuvenated. I arrive fresh. It's just great.
I came here by tube, and I mean, I don't live in London. It therefore comes as a constant surprise to me to sit and look at the grey, miserable faces on the tube. And I mean, I know that's a cliche, but it is a fact. You look at people and you think, this is unpleasant to you. Why do you do this every day in life? It's a beautiful sunny day out here. There is still only a small percentage of Londoners on their bikes. Why? I mean, when it's so glaringly apparent they could be having more fun out here, why are they still down there?
I think a big factor is that there's nowhere to leave your bike most businesses. And I think that is something that needs to change. When all businesses have adequate parking for cycles, when they have a shower facility, then I think we'll see the number of cyclists increase. There's no question from surveys that 10 to 25% of the people in this town are prepared to cycle given the right conditions. So what we've got to do, if we want to increase cycling, reduce congestion, is to create those conditions. And that means facilities in the workplace, better facilities on the roads, and more information out to the people who want to cycle.
You know, it genuinely never occurred to me that cycling through London could be as pleasant as this. We're just going past the boating pond in Hyde Park. Beautiful summer's day. Clear blue skies, trees are all out, people sitting in deck chairs. And Matt Seaton is with me, cycling along on his bike at the moment. And Matt's a Guardian columnist. The fact that the Guardian now has a cycling column, does that indicate a resurgence in cycling?
You notice it sort of palpably in London, but I think it's, you know, it's happening elsewhere as well.
What is the reason behind the resurgence of cycling in London? I mean, is it just congestion charging?
That has definitely helped. I mean, that gave cycling a big push. It just made it more pleasant to be cycling in central London. But the congestion charge is only a small part of London, so it's obviously not the whole picture. It's obviously a part of London where a lot of people commute to work in, so that does help. I think sort of psychologically, almost, it made a difference to people. They realised, you know, it gave a message that, you know, going by private car or struggling in on public transport was, you know, maybe not the cleverest way anymore, and that cycling is not only a kind of rational choice, but it actually can be fun as well. And I think it's one of those things where it snowballs as well. The more people you see cycling, the more people think, oh, well, maybe I'll get my bike out. And of course, the more bikes there are on the road, the safer all cyclists are and feel. And I think one of the major disincentives, the reason people always give for not cycling, is that they don't feel safe, that they feel it's too dangerous.
Has the attitude of drivers towards cyclists actually changed in London over the last couple of years?
I don't know that it necessarily has. I mean, I'm sure a lot of drivers find cyclists pretty annoying. You know, they see them going through red lights, they see them kind of, you know, ignoring traffic signals and road signs, and they must sit there in their cars just cursing us. I suppose there's more tolerance in the sense that, motorists now see things like advanced stop lines at traffic lights, and you know, they see the picture of the bicycle painted on the tarmac, and that just gives them a subliminal message that, you know, cyclists have priority, they have a right to be in that road space. That makes a huge difference.
Gee, I followed you up here to Hyde Park through the traffic, and you've actually got quite a radical cycling style. But what I found really, because we were on the outside of the traffic sometimes, there was oncoming traffic, what I found really quite heartening was the fact that the bus drivers and the taxi drivers seemed nearly as keen on keeping me alive as I was.
Well, actually, I always think that badmouth taxi drivers a lot, and also sometimes rude about bus drivers. Personally, I think bus drivers and taxi drivers are some of the most skilled drivers around, and because they drive every day in London traffic, you know, they're really careful about their blind spots. They're using their mirrors all the time, and also, you know, they depend on their livelihood. The last thing they want is a damned insurance claim, you know, to deal with. So actually, I think they're the most, I mean, you know, they may have utter contempt for you as a cyclist, but, you know, they're not going to cause an accident. They're not going to be reckless, you know. I think often it's the people who actually aren't used to driving in traffic every day that become more impatient and behave more aggressively sometimes.
Is the culture of cycling, I suppose by culture I mean, is the perception of cycling changing?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think we've been through decades where cycling was perceived as really the poor person's mode of travel, a kind of second-class citizenship, and in effect, you know, it was almost kind of planned out of existence by sort of, you know, traffic engineers and road planners, and you know, we've really gone almost 180 degrees from that now. I think cycling is perceived as, you could almost say cool. You know, it's desirable. People are interested in it. People are talking about it. You know, there are now newspaper columns devoted to it. It's very funny when you've been in the wilderness for years. It's kind of quite odd suddenly to find yourself riding the crest of the wave of interest about it.
But you don't get yet, or I haven't seen one yet, the kind of glossy, sex-laden ads for bicycles that you get for cars.
No, but very interestingly, just recently, I noticed there's a lot of billboards for a new people carrier of some description, and there's just a small picture of the vehicle and a huge picture of this kind of, you know, athletic, sort of powerful-looking cyclist whose bike is sort of made, wheels of the bike are like the alloy wheels of this car. And, I mean, that's fascinating that you're seeing a car being marketed through, you know, the image that cycling creates, which is therefore of, you know, something desirable, sexy almost, and powerful. Who would have thought you'd see, you know, cars sold by bikes?
My name is Hawa Bunduka. I cycle from Broccoli into Old Street for work. And this is my bike, which I shipped over from Namibia.
The idea of bringing anything this venerable, because it's seen better years, it has to be said, all the way from Africa to here just tickles me pink. Why? What was the logic behind it?
I don't think there really was any logic, other than I had to move a whole house back to the UK anyway. And because it is kind of a wreck, but, you know, a functioning wreck, I didn't think it was going to get nicked in London, which is... I mean, I've had a bike nicked before and didn't really want to experience that again, so...
It's quite cunning, reverse psychology.
It is, yeah. It's worked so far.
Here is my unprized product. Feel free to walk past it.
Yes.
Have you noticed a difference in cycling around London over the last couple of years?
Slowly, yeah, there's actually more women cycling. I mean, I've been cycling for probably about 15 years or so around London, if not a little bit more. So actually, I've started to see more black women cyclists, and I didn't used to see that many. Slightly more.
Why not?
I've got absolutely no idea.
As a regular cyclist in London, I mean, how close have you come to the bitter edge?
Well, in 15 plus years of cycling, I've been knocked off twice, and both times were kind of quite low-key. Somebody opened a car door on me, and another time somebody kind of decided to take herself off the roundabout and straight into my path. But neither of those were that major. But on a daily basis, it's not so much that I feel I'm endangering my life, I feel that other people are endangering my life. And I'm saying that because I am an experienced cyclist, and I do ride defensively. But people are always driving far too close, always cutting you up, always sitting in the cycle lanes, you know, at the lights, when they're supposed to kind of leave it free, so you're jammed in between buses and stuff, people crossing the road without looking. One of the things that I've noticed is a lot of the people that are cycling, maybe on the kind of anti-congestion charge tip, haven't necessarily been cycling for that long on the road, so they don't have that confidence to really assert themselves on the road. I am on the road and I'm going to do this move now. You do see people pulling crazy stunts and kind of thinking, God, that was really, really dangerous. So there is that thing, isn't there? There's that tension between motorists and motorcyclists and cyclists, and that I think that needs to be knocked on the head, really.
I wonder if there's an aspect of this that's a class thing too, because you see the vast majority of cyclists in London, you know, and they're white and middle class and affluent and things, and a lot of the van drivers ain't, you know, and I wonder if that's part of the source of the friction.
I've never thought about it in that way. I think it's much more mixed. I think the people that are kind of cycling around, maybe not to and from work, but, you know, maybe around my area, a lot of the people that are cycling are kind of working class, young people.
How many of the people that cycle that you know would actually stand up and say, yes, I'm doing this for the environment, hand on heart?
I think most people are doing it, most of the people I know are doing it for their pocket, to be honest, and their health. Basically, when it's not raining, it is a really efficient way of getting around London.
Rush hour in Copenhagen, and it's kind of disconcerting cycling in the middle of a shoal of cyclists. I mean, there are a lot of them here. And while it's wonderful that the number of cyclists is going up in London, it's actually mirrored UK-wide. The number of people using the national cycle networks last year went up by 15% to about 232 million journeys. Interestingly, of that, over a quarter, some 28% were people commuting to and from work. And while that's very promising in a UK context, it doesn't begin to match what they've achieved here in Copenhagen.
It's a friendly city for bikers. Fresh air, we are living at sea.
It's very easy and it's nice, and I do it all the year.
Each day, I think between 100,000 and 150,000 people bike.
It's a beautiful sunny afternoon here in Copenhagen, and people are out here taking advantage of the sunshine. The cafe tables are full. There are people swarming all over the plaza. They're sitting all around the fountain there. And there's probably about 400 or 500 bicycles parked in this square.
Cycling here is the norm. Lots and lots of people cycle. But why? What is it about Copenhagen that makes them want to cycle?
You can park all over. You don't have to look for a parking place.
Is it just simply convenience, or is there an element in it where people are saying, well, I'm doing something for the environment?
I think it's both, but Copenhagen is a city not very friendly to cars, and that's a praise to the Danish Social Democrats. They're very friendly to bikers.
Just standing beside one of the canals here in Copenhagen. And it's lovely. All these sort of pastel houses down the side there. There's a forest of masts down just either side of the canal. A couple of big lightships too. Behind me there are pedestrians, there are cyclists, there are cars moving up very, very slowly and very, very carefully. Across there is a major intersection with more cars and pickup trucks and buses and lorries and everything else. And what's really impressive about Copenhagen is just how well they managed to integrate everything, to get everything to coexist side by side. And it must be a really difficult balancing act. Klaus Bondam is a city mayor for infrastructure and environmental issues.
It is not an easy balance act. It's a very complicated one, but we are in these years extremely helped by the Copenhageners. Over 40% of Copenhageners use their bicycle every single day of the year. My generation, I'm 42, and generations before me, we were brought up as a cycling generations. We were put on bicycles from the age of 4 or 5 years old. I still remember my first trip on a bicycle down the hill, and I was so scared, I just took my hands up to the eyes and went into a lamppost. but I went up again. No, I think that we start early and you keep on with it. But when that is said, I mean, Copenhageners are also practical people, and you can actually also see it in our Danish and Scandinavian design. We are very practically concerned people, and practically, if you want to get easy around in Copenhagen, it is by bicycle.
It's crossing over the canal now and heading for one of the main bridges into Copenhagen city centre itself. Now, the cycle lane I'm on is actually raised off the road by 2 or 3 inches. You can imagine there's the road, and then there's the cycle lane, which is almost like a broad pavement. This one's about 7 feet broad. And then there's another curb, and there's the pavement proper for the pedestrians. So everybody is sort of properly demarcated. There's a blue lane across this intersection to show this is the route the cyclist is supposed to take. And it's pretty safe. Hit one of these bridges that raises up, and there's a barrier being lowered down in front of me, and they're just going to open the bridge, and the bridge is now lifting up. There's about 40 foot of bridge facing right up in front of me, and broken glass falling off what would have been the pavement. Just turned round, and there are maybe 150 to 200 cyclists behind me. And on the left-hand side, there's a cycle courier, which is, must be a really strange position to hold in Copenhagen, where just about everybody's a cyclist. Having spotted the couriers down here, and there can be few people in Copenhagen that cycle more than these folk, what is it actually like cycling in Copenhagen? Is it as good as people make out?
No. Because we have to use bike lanes here, which really sucks. I used to ride in England for about 8 years as a messenger, and it's much easier when you can cut between the traffic. But here, if you sometimes you have to get off the bike lanes because of roadworks, and the cars will try and run you down because they want to point out that you're breaking the law.
It is very much a case here that everybody follows the law, you know, and if, as I've done several times so far, because I don't understand the rules and regulations here, I've inadvertently crossed the line, they're not long in telling you about it.
Actually, the other bikers are pretty much not following the law. They're not looking where they're going, and they're pretty much minding their own little self. So it's quite a chaos biking in Copenhagen.
Yeah, I would have thought, I mean, if people here are cycling from the age of 5 onwards, they would be pretty good at it by the time they got, you know, to adulthood and onto the streets itself proper. But you're saying that's not the case?
I think they kind of daydream around here, maybe just because they do it all the time. They just ride along texting or talking on their phones or,
I've seen that actually.
Thinking about what they're going to have for dinner tonight, so they just cruise out. Because I also ride a motorcycle, and then you get notice from the other side as a motorist, how it is with the cyclists, and they just cruise right out in front of you. But also on the bicycles, a lot of us ride track bikes here, and often without brakes, so you've got to really watch ahead, and then there'll be someone who's just riding along, they'll do something stupid right in front of you, whether it's a bicycle or a pedestrian or a car driver.
Have you cycled in London?
Motorcycling and messengering in London and Cambridge.
So how do the two compare? I mean, which do you prefer?
London.
You prefer London?
Yeah, because the cars can't drive anywhere, they're stuck. Although I haven't been riding there since the...
Congestion charter.
Yeah, so yeah. Maybe traffic's flowing a bit faster now, but it seemed when I was riding there that they could either went so slow that if they hit you, there's a good chance it's not going to do much, or otherwise you can just ride between them and get away from it. I got a nice scar here from someone just walking into a bike lane last year, and he stopped in the middle of the bike lane to try and think about which way he was going to go, and I hit him and landed on my head, but I couldn't use the road because the cars won't give you space to cut around them or anything.
One must not forget that bicyclists are also drivers sometimes, and you have a tendency to change your way of thinking whether you sit behind a steering wheel or you are on your bicycle.
What was the original driver? I mean, going back to, say, the 1970s, you know, when the politicians in Copenhagen picked up this idea and said, look, let's try and make this city more cycle-friendly, let's get more cycles back on the road. Why? Why did they do that?
I think you have to look a bit more back into history. If you're not aware of it, I can tell you that Denmark has the highest taxation on cars in not only Europe, but I would say in the world. A car is extremely expensive in Denmark. That, of course, means that you have to have a certain level in your income to be able to afford a car. Copenhagen used to be a worker city. We were not a rich people city. And, of course, the bicycle was the means of transportation for the worker, for the everyday, ordinary man. We are a city with a lot of green areas close to the city and a lot of blue areas, a lot of water close to our city. So if you're after a hard day at the shipyard or a hard day at the factory, you wanted to have some leisure time, well, invest in a bicycle and you could take your family out. I mean, Copenhagen has always been a bicycle city. Then I think it changed that being environmentally concerned became a trend. And then I think also there is a Danish practicality in it. I mean, there is a practical thing. We are practical people. And you can, as I said before, you can see it in our design also. We are practically concerned people. And to use a bicycle in Copenhagen, that is the practical way of transporting yourself.
As a people, you seem to be very good at looking after your own comforts. Mm. You know, silly things I've noticed, like the park benches are in the right places. When I want to sit down, there's a park bench there, and it's facing the right way. Right. I mean, there's just something in the Danish psyche that says, look, there's a practical solution here, and, you know, why shouldn't we be comfortable?
I think that that is one of the things that we as Copenhageners and as Dane can export to the rest of Europe. All of us are experiencing the same development, that people want to live in urban areas. So we are facing a challenge that more people are going to live more close together. How do we solve that? How do we divide that space we have? How do we divide it so we can all be here? And of course, taking your bicycle it takes up less space. Keep your car for the weekend, going to the summer house or going to the ocean or whatever you do, or visiting your family in the countryside, but leave it for that. We can teach the rest of Europe about bicycling. London, of course, is a major experience for us now in congestion charge. But I think it's very important that we in Europe exchange these different experiences that we have. And we really do know a lot here, a lot.
You know, there is really no sense in which Copenhagen is run by the anti-car mafia. People here are cycling because they choose to cycle and they see it as a life-enhancing choice. There's a lot we can learn from a city like Copenhagen.
It's doing them a power of good, and better still, it's doing the road networks a power of good. The fate of the bicycle is intimately linked to our own fates now, because it will be a test case whether or not we can wean ourselves off the motor car, whether or not we can shake that habit and shift to the peaceful, simple joys of cycling may well determine whether we can solve the ultimate life-threatening question of whether there's runaway climate change or not. So the simple bicycle and the fate of the simple bicycle could well be linked to our own ultimate fate as a civilization.
The Fall and Rise of the Bicycle was presented by Mark Stephen and produced in Edinburgh by Kate Bissell. In the final part at the same time next week, Mark travels to China.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed listening to that half-hour show of the BBC. As the gentleman said in the end there, that was The Fall and Rise of the Bicycle. It's there were three broadcasts of this miniseries, and we were listening to Europe, the once and future king of the road. If you want to listen to that again, all you need to do is go to www.bbc.co.uk/radio4, and 4 is the numeric 4, /Fall and Rise of the Bicycle, all one word. And from there, you'll get all the information, and you can listen to it online. And yeah, it was very interesting. He spoke about how the vehicles are very heavily taxed in Copenhagen, and it reminds me of a number of years ago when I was working in the automotive industry. I had a lot of communication with the Mercedes-Benz Club of Germany, and they were always amazed at how many V8s people could own in the States. They thought we were, or in Canada, they thought we were all rich, because in Germany, when you pay for your registration of your vehicle every year, it's there's a flat fee, but it's also you pay on how many cubic inches your engine displaces. So everybody drives four cylinders. Not everybody, but a lot of people do in Germany because it's a lot cheaper. We had done a conversion, and this goes back to about the year 2000, on what it would cost to own a V8 Mercedes-Benz in Germany at the time, and it was close to about $5,000 Canadian a year that you would pay just to register the vehicle, which is drastically different than what we do here. I know in Ontario, back in the 60s or 70s, I can't quite remember because I wasn't alive, but when you got your license plate, there was a sticker on the plate that you paid for whether you had a four-cylinder, six-cylinder, eight-cylinder, and depending on how many cylinders you had in your vehicle, the sticker, of course, for the eight-cylinder cost a lot more than the four-cylinder. It would be nice to go back to that time, or even to start changing the way we register vehicles, but I imagine all the people that are complaining about the gas prices these days would even complain more about paying more money to register their vehicles. So unfortunately, I think it's going to take a bit of a mind shift for that to ever come around again. Also, I thought it was kind of funny that he said Copenhagen is not friendly to vehicles. I don't know if there's a time in the future when we could say that about Vancouver, but I think it's about time that the city starts taking a little more seriously the bicycle mode of transportation, and even looking at closing off certain roads to motor vehicle traffic, like the 10th Street bicycle route would be a perfect example of making it bicycles only. But one can only dream, that's for sure. Anyways, I'll be back after this break.
Some more. If you are poor, you must forage so you can gorge. 'Tis a season gluttony, no rhyme or reason, it's just a season gluttony, gluttony. Who's the saint of that sin? gimme, gimme, and a whole lot of gimme more. Hear the chimes in harmony, listen to the gimme choir. Tis the season gluttony, no rhyme or reason, it's just the season gluttony, gluttony. Who's the saint of that sin? Another piece of pie, dear. There's always room for more, dear. There's no need to cry. Tis the season gluttony. No rhyme or reason, it's just the season gluttony, gluttony. Who's the saint of that sin? Tis the season gluttony. No rhyme or reason, it's just the season gluttony, gluttony. Who's the saint of that sin?
Okay, so I know it's not Christmas. That's what happens when you use some old CDs that you find in your little cubbyhole here at CITR. You are listening to 101.9 FM CITR, broadcasting from the University of British Columbia. And I hope you're enjoying our show today. Some of you might have gone to the Gastown or the Tour de Gastown yesterday. Which was apparently very exciting. I wasn't there. About 35,000 people showed up to watch 200 riders compete in the 1.2 kilometer course. Amazingly enough, this Tour de Gastown has been happening since 1973, and people from all over North America come to compete in it, which this year I believe the prize money was $15,000. And also the BC Cancer Foundation uses it as a fundraiser, and they were able to raise $10,000 for their charitable purposes. And interestingly enough, the top three winners in the women's race, the first person, Gina Grain, is from Burnaby. The second person that came in was Kelly Benjamin, and she was from Kansas City, Missouri. Third in place was Ruth Corsett, and coming all the way from New Zealand, actually. So I guess it's not just North America, it's worldwide. In the men's top three, you had first place Andrew Pinfold from North Vancouver, second place Hilton Clark from Sydney, Australia, and third place Zach Bell from Burnaby. So we can see that BC had some good showings there. Apparently, five of the bicyclists in the Tour de Gastown were also people that are competing in the upcoming Summer Olympics. In the Metro News, again, the one that I snagged from the garbage can, I found, while listening to the BBC show, a little letter here from somebody which kind of made me chuckle. I don't know how factual it is, but I'll read it here. In the letters to the editor, the title is Helmet Fine Odd in Comparison. After seeing a bicyclist get a ticket yesterday for not wearing a helmet, I was reminded that taking heroin in parts of Vancouver is legal. But not wearing a helmet while cycling is a crime throughout the entire municipality. That was by a fellow Vancouverite writing into the editor. Interesting thought. Well, I hope you've enjoyed our show today, and I'm sure that you'll hear another one of the BBC Fall and Rise of the Bicycle episodes again in the future if you don't have access to the internet. You'll hear it here on the Pedal Revolutionary show. Everybody ride safe and enjoy the sun. I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, but September is coming up and so is the rain, so enjoy the sun while you can. And maybe we'll hear some more Christmas music. I'm not sure. Have a good night.
It was a lucky April shower. It was the most convenient dawn. I found $1 million baby in a 5 and 10 cent store. The rain continued for an hour. I hung around for 3 or 4. Around $1 million baby in a 5 and 10 cent store. She was selling china, and when she made those lines, I kept buying china until the crowd got wide. Incidentally, if you should run into a shower, just step inside my cottage door and meet the $1 million baby from the 5 and 10 cent store.
Ago in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR:
it's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.